This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a deadly earthquake hits Afghanistan and Pakistan. An American guided missile destroyer could challenge China in the South China Sea. Drones take on wildfires.
We can fight fires 24/7, unmanned, and or optionally manned, and so that's the advantage. You know, you can get water on the fires, you know, 14, 15 extra hours a day where a manned system can't.
A 19-year-old singer goes after the meaning of beauty. These stories are more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. A major earthquake struck a remote area of northern Afghanistan Monday, killing almost 300 people there and in neighboring Pakistan, and injuring more than 1,700. The 7.5 magnitude quake was centered deep beneath the Hindu Kush Mountains in Afghanistan's sparsely populated Badakhshan province, which borders Pakistan, Tajikistan, and China. The hardest hit area reported so far is Pakistan's northwestern Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, where officials confirm at least 140 people killed and more than 1,000 injured. 59 people are reported dead in Afghanistan. But that number is expected to rise dramatically. The toll in Afghanistan includes 12 schoolgirls who were killed in a stampede as they rushed out of shaking buildings in Takhar province. Reporter Ayaz Gul in Islamabad told us about the damage and its impact.
Well, it seems that there has been extensive damage, particularly in northwestern Pakistan. I mean, the area which borders Afghanistan, and we know that the epicenter of the earthquake was located in Afghanistan. So the northwestern mountainous region of Pakistan suffered the most. You know, it's mainly in this part of Pakistan. It's not very well developed area, and mostly it's mud houses, and the structures, especially residential structures, are not that strong enough to sustain this kind of a shock. I mean, the way the earthquake shook entire Pakistan, we could imagine that there must have been a lot of damage. But because it's nighttime and the earthquake happened in the late afternoon, so obviously it will take some time before the authorities come up with some real assessment of exactly what kind of damage that has occurred in that area. And we have been told that maybe by Tuesday morning, the military missions that have been dispatched to the area to assess the damage will be able to provide some initial reports.
Ayaz Gul also described his personal experience when the earthquake struck.
Well, it was really a very strong tremor. You know, as soon as it hit, I mean, it was a terrible. I was sitting on the second, on the first floor of my house with my kids, and we all had to just flee the home. We were just thinking maybe it's going to come down on us, and we just went outside in the street where hundreds of people had already gathered. At the, you know, the way this thing started, we didn't feel initially, but we realized once we were on the street that people were already afraid of it and scared, and they were all gathered there, and we were with them. But we could see then, you know, the way the windows were shaking and our houses, the entire houses, you know, back and forth, they were swinging here and there. And it was quite an amazing scene to have experienced, because it continued. The earthquake persisted for about a minute, and it was quite intense. And it was really, I mean, we were scared, and it took us a while before we came back to our homes, because everybody was scared maybe it will come back again. So it was quite a terrible experience that not only we personally experienced, but all over Pakistan, especially those areas which were hit by the earthquake. And it reminded us of the kind of experience we have had in 2005 of October 8th in that year. And that was also the epicenter of that earthquake was not far from Islamabad, and it shook us at that time. But today's, because the duration was so long, that it really scared everybody.
Reporter Ayaz Gul in Islamabad. The massive earthquake also triggered landslides in mountainous northern and northwestern Pakistan. The U.S. Geological Survey registered two tremors with magnitudes of 4.7 and 4.8 in the same region within 90 minutes of the major quake. Reports say buildings also swayed in the Indian capital, New Delhi, forcing office workers out into the streets. A U.S. guided missile destroyer is said to be within 12 nautical miles of China's artificial islands in the South China Sea. A U.S. defense official described it Monday as a long-anticipated challenge to what he called Beijing's excessive claims to sovereignty in those waters. The USS Lassen was dispatched near reefs in the Spratly Archipelago. The U.S. cites international law in its stance that artificial reefs do not entitle a country to a territorial water claim. I spoke with Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb about this U.S. naval action.
The United States has said for some time now that international law says that there's no way that an artificial island has any sort of territorial water claim. And the United States has been operating in the South China Sea many times before the United States has been operating near the artificial territories of the Philippines and Vietnam, going within that 12 nautical miles or 22-kilometer area. And the U.S. says that this is their right, and they have to stand up for the international community and follow international law, which does not give these islands any sort of sovereignty.
Is sending a destroyer enough of a threat?
Well, it's a start. This patrol would mark the most serious U.S. challenge to China's claim of territorial sovereignty around these islands. So it's not meant to go to war by any means. It's just meant to say, under the U.N. Convention of the Law of the Seas, artificial islands do not possess the status of having territorial seas of their own, and we are just enforcing that international law.
Has China expressed any opposition to this threat before this even happened?
Well, China has said before that it will defend its territories. It's warned that it's not going to allow any country to violate the airspace or the water space of the Spratly Archipelago. But this archipelago was submerged before China and only existed in 2014, and so the United States says, well, we've been flying over the archipelago for a long time now, and this is not going to change the way we operate just because you say it's so.
Has the U.S. done any similar type of action in recent years?
They have patrolled near the territories built up by the Philippines and built up by Vietnam, and they have been operating in the South China Sea. Now, don't forget how important the South China Sea is. It's one of the world's busiest shipping routes. So the U.S. is not doing this as any sort of reason to bully China or any way of that nature. This is directly affecting U.S. economic interest, because if China were to enforce control over this certain part of the sea, that would affect international shipping routes, and the United States is not going to allow that to happen.
VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. The patrol marks the most serious U.S. challenge to China's claim of territorial sovereignty around the islands. China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi urged Washington to act cautiously during its patrol. European leaders meeting in Brussels are pledging to cooperate to control the flow of tens of thousands of migrants and refugees flooding the continent from South Asia, the Middle East, and Africa, even as cold weather begins to move in over Europe's worst post-war humanitarian crisis. They are expanding reception capacities and border controls while improving the registration and screening process for those who survive the journey. Jean-Claude Juncker is president of the European Commission. He is followed by the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Antonio Guterres.
We will increase reception capacities to 100,000 places in Greece and in the Western Balkans. To safeguard Schengen, we also need to strengthen border management between Greece, the former ex-Yugoslavic Republic of Macedonia, Albania, and Serbia. In addition, we will deploy 400 police officers to Slovenia within a week.
I do believe that the decisions that were in consensus among those present in this meeting will give an important contribution to allow for the right bodies of the European Union to take the decisions that are needed to make sure that this situation that we always considered it was manageable will become effectively managed. First of all, to the benefit of the people in need, but also to guarantee the union and the stability of the European institutions.
Slovenia has been coping with tens of thousands of people who've arrived in the tiny alpine country in just the last week and a half. Davy Sims is a former BBC journalist who spoke with International Edition's Victor Beattie from the resort village of Bled.
It will not stem the flow, not immediately, and certainly not within the next few weeks. But I think the important thing, or there are several important things that have come from this crisis meeting, and I think the most important thing is, first of all, the assistance that is going to be shown to the Balkan region, and also the improvement in communication. There has been very poor communication between some of the countries. And where I'm speaking from, Slovenia, and the next-door neighbour, Croatia, there have been an exchange of very harsh words over the past 7 to 10 days. I have also already noted this morning that there has been a note in one of the news agencies, the Slovenian news agency, that already communication has improved between the two countries, and the police in Croatia are alerting the police in Slovenia as to where they will be delivering the refugees and the migrants.
Slovenia's Prime Minister Miro Cerar warned that the EU itself is at stake as he arrived for those talks. Quote, if we don't deliver some immediate and concrete actions on the ground in the next few days and weeks, I believe the EU and Europe as a whole will start falling apart, unquote.
It sounds as if it's an exaggeration. You could counter it by saying the European Union has a much longer view than one immediate crisis. And there are several crises facing the European Union. But I think that Cerar is saying something that is important for his own electorate to hear. Angela Merkel, the premier from Germany, did not quite disagree and said this is one of the litmus tests that Europe is facing at the moment. So this is an important litmus test, or Europe falling apart. I think Merkel probably has the correct emphasis, but Cerar is very concerned. This is a very small country. Last night, since he spoke, 15,000 more refugees have arrived in the country. I think his electorate, his people here, need to hear strong, not harsh, but strong words as he goes into a negotiation.
Well, this meeting also produced a promise of some 400 border guards to Slovenia. Is that going to help them control the situation?
Certainly, I think it's already been welcomed by the Slovenian news agencies. 400 border guards, 400 police coming in to help will certainly will help improve things. The information that we get, Victor, at the moment is the number of people who are arriving. What we're not quite clear on is the number of people who are leaving, because this is a transit area. The migrants and the refugees do not want to stay in Slovenia. They're bound for other places. Slovenia is a poor country. It has relatively high unemployment. It has difficulty in managing the refugees. And while I'm talking about 15,000 arriving overnight, or expected, estimated, there are other estimates, around 100,000 in the past 9 days, says one report, and 60,000 in the past 6 days, says another report. But we don't know how quickly they are leaving the country. They're being processed, certainly. They're not staying here. The border guards will help to get people through the country from where they are coming from, which is the southern Balkans, through Croatia, then on through Slovenia and into Austria.
Former BBC journalist Davy Sims speaking with International Edition's Victor Beattie. This is VOA.
This is Greenbeat for a healthier planet.
One man's trash is another man's treasure, and in Indonesia, you can bank on that, literally. A government initiative has established a few trash banks where residents like Yuliang Engshi can gather up recyclable bottles and deposit them at a bank in Cimahi. This is so I can have a little extra saved up for my expenses. The trash bank in Cimahi was initially set up 5 years ago by the Sanitary and Environmental Agency. Budi Raharja is head of the sanitation agency. He says they would eventually like to expand into recycling.
As of now, we're still focusing on the collection process, collecting trash from our residents, which we then sell to garbage collectors or have it collected for processing.
A recent study indicates Indonesia is the world's second largest plastic polluter, generating more than 3 million tons of mismanaged plastic waste in 2010. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
This is VOA's International Edition. Turning now to social media, there's much ado about something the World Health Organization is saying. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here with us to talk about what's buzzing online. Hello, G.
Hi, Ray.
G, what's trending on Twitter today?
The latest press release from the World Health Organization is all over the internet. The WHO and the International Agency for Research on Cancer evaluated the consumption of red and processed meat and concluded those products are in fact carcinogenic. Ray, this is something many people have believed for some time because the correlation between meat consumption and the occurrence of cancer has been researched before. But it is the first time the UN agency has publicly warned against meat consumption.
And that no doubt has a lot of people around the world quite upset and concerned. And
of course,
the WHO must be tweeting something about it.
Yes, this is the agency's first tweet about the findings. The International Agency for Research on Cancer, the cancer agency of WHO, classified processed meat as carcinogenic to humans, Group 1. More than 2,500 people share that tweet. Its following tweets include, experts concluded that each 50-gram portion of processed meat eaten daily increases the risk of colorectal cancer by 18%. It went on to tweet that the association between red meat and pancreatic and prostate cancer also exists. The agency sent out several tweets regarding the latest findings Monday.
Again, this no doubt will have a lot of people very upset. It's saying that processed meat is worse than unprocessed red meat. Is that correct?
Yes. So it classified processed meat as carcinogenic to humans and unprocessed red meat as probably carcinogenic to humans. And of course, the big meat industry dissented right away.
Well, tell us what the big meat industry is saying.
Here in America, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association is a very powerful body with incredible lobbying power to Congress. So they came back right away with a tweet that reads like this. Science does not support international agency opinion on red meat and cancer. But unfortunately for the association, it's been retweeted only 8 times. The NCBA's policy division is on Twitter at Beltway Beef. Ray?
Thanks, G. You can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. That's J-E-E-A-B-B-E-Y-L-E-E. And also by following our program's account at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition coming to you from Washington. Drones have been in the news a lot lately concerning their military and personal use. One aspect not so well known about drones is their capability to help fight fires. The K-MAX chopper is the largest of several remotely piloted firefighting aircraft to get a tryout. Correspondent Tom Bonsi reports from the western city of Boise, Idaho.
It was suitably smoky out when the dual-rotor K-MAX powered up for an audience of federal firefighting managers. The late-season wildfire in central Idaho supplied the unplanned haze. Defense contractor Lockheed Martin and Helicopter Maker Command supplied the glimpse into unmanned aerial firefighting.
So we got the aircraft coming in now for the second spot drop.
The helicopter looks like it's been squished in from the sides. It demonstrated water drops and ferried supplies up and down a mountain. All of the missions were flown by remote control from a ground station set up next to the helipad. A pilot sat in the one-seat cockpit ready to take the controls just in case.
Requesting a second spot drop. Have the coordinates when you're ready to copy.
Command Aerospace Vice President Bob Manaski says the helicopter can fly through thick smoke or darkness, situations that force current firefighting aircraft to stay on the ground.
We can fight fires 24/7, unmanned, and or optionally manned, and so that's the advantage. You know, you can get water on the fires, you know, 14, 15 extra hours a day where a manned system can't.
Manaske says the U.S. Marine Corps operated two K-MAX helicopters in the unmanned configuration in Afghanistan to resupply remote outposts at night. K-MAX shuttles replaced dangerous convoys on the ground.
We've tweaked it to where it is very safe. When we put it in Afghanistan, initially the Marines wouldn't put people underneath the aircraft as it was hovering because they were afraid it would, you know, unmanned, it would fall down. And by the end, there were tons of people under there hooking up stuff. So it just, they got very confident with it. And that's what it is.
A K-MAX helicopter costs about $7.5 million. It can lift up to 2,700 kilos, the equivalent of its own weight. U.S. Forest Service Assistant Director for Aviation Art Hinneman says he saw a lot of potential at the initial pitch.
It's fascinating that it can be done, that the technology is there. And for us, the ability to do that without having to risk a pilot in low light level conditions and poor visibility and weather that you just can't fly and the guys on the ground need the help, it's pretty monumental.
The K-MAX helicopter is the third remotely piloted aircraft to get a federal tryout this season. The first two tests used smaller winged aircraft to identify and map hotspots. Boeing's subsidiary Insitu showed off a repurposed military reconnaissance drone called the Scan Eagle, this over a forest fire in Olympic National Park. Then Textron Corporation demonstrated its Aerosonde Mark IV surveillance drone over a different forest fire north of McCall, Idaho. So how soon will drones routinely help at wildfires? Brad Keckerts is the unmanned aircraft program manager with the U.S. Department of Interior. He figures it will take a few more years to integrate drones into all the other routines found at wildfires.
I truly believe that systems like unmanned K-MAX and other optionally piloted aircraft will become a tool that's going to be regularly used by the firefighters to support them over time.
There is an element of good drone, bad drone to this. More than a dozen times this year, unauthorized hobby drones flew too close to active wildfires in the American West that forced temporary halts to aerial firefighting operations. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi in Boise, Idaho.
Musician and actress Zendaya recently criticized a French fashion magazine for altering her image after a photo shoot. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with Soul Lounge host Shona Renee about the issue, which has a 19-year-old singer taking on the images of beauty, both thin and not so thin.
Shona, Zendaya is a beautiful young woman, and yet when she was in this model shoot for Modeliste magazine, they photoshopped her to make her a little bit more zoftig, a little rounder, you know? It was like she's a thin young woman.
She is. And keep in mind, she is also a young woman. She's also very tall. So, and this is something that she's talked about in the past, the fact that she felt a little insecure about being as tall as she is and as thin as she is. So I think that's what prompted her reaction after seeing the touched images that were to appear or that did appear in this magazine.
And the shot in question, she's in briefs and a black leather jacket. And she's kind of in the traditional S shape that they put fashion models in. But they made her hips and her thighs a little rounder, a little thicker. And was that to appeal to a certain audience, or did they just think she was too skinny, or what?
Well, I think it's probably a combination of both. There are differing standards of beauty, and they change as time goes on, as time changes. And now we know that a slightly more curvaceous body is more appealing, and it has always been to men. And I think that again is a problem, that we're talking about a young girl that they were attempting to alter in a way that could potentially make it more appealing to older men, but also to set this standard, I think, for young women. And that's what magazines are setting: unrealistic standards for young women in fashion magazines, music videos, everywhere, really.
Everywhere I go, play you everywhere I go. Put you on repeat, play you everywhere I go. Everywhere I go, play you everywhere I go.
There was an article a couple of days ago about a woman who is slightly curvaceous, who gave her husband a photo book of boudoir photography.
I saw that, yeah.
And he said, I don't like it.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like my wife, you know? And
yeah.
So the photoshopping of this image, which she intended to be kind of an idealized version of herself,
yeah.
He didn't like.
Yeah, it took away. And I thought it was beautiful what he said, because he's like, you know, you erased our life together.
Yeah.
You know, you erased the children that we have. You erased the laugh lines. You've erased everything. And it's even worse now, because before, that was just something that you saw in magazines. That was the standard for people who were in the public eye. Now, with all of these apps and everything, anyone, I mean, I do it sometimes. If I take a picture and I'm like, oh, you know what? I don't like that. Filter it. Or, you know, you can now Photoshop your own body and extend it and do all kinds of stuff. So, I mean, really, I like what she's doing, because at the end of the day, it's like, you know, when you walk down the street, we all see what you look like in
you look like
the real world anyway. You look like you.
Okay. All righty. Yeah. Well, if you have any comments on this, please send them to us. You can tweet to Shauna at VOA Lady DJ. You can tweet to us at VOA underscore IE. You can also comment on our webpage. That's voanews.com.
And now, hello, Google Zendaya. That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news, information, videos, and podcasts on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Gender-based violence is a scourge from which no country is immune. It is estimated that globally, one out of three women faces violence during her lifetime for no other reason than her gender. As unfortunately commonplace as gender-based violence is under normal circumstances, it increases exponentially during conflict, natural disasters, and other humanitarian emergencies. In emergency situations, societal structures break down, and women and girls in particular face an increased risk of gender-based violence, including sexual exploitation and abuse, rape, domestic violence, forced marriage, and trafficking. That is why 2 years ago, representatives of a number of governments, transnational organizations, NGOs, and civil society organizations met in London under the leadership of the United Kingdom to form a call to action on protecting girls and women in emergencies. The United States took on leadership of the call to action in 2014. As a commitment to the call to action, the United States announced its Safe from the Start program, an initiative that aims to address and reduce the incidence of gender-based violence in emergencies. We have used Safe from the Start funding to help our partners assist thousands of displaced Iraqis. Safe from the Start supported training for refugees from the Central African Republic on how to respond to sexual exploitation and abuse, setting up complaint mechanisms and emergency phone lines to report abuses. And in the Congo, we are helping to establish security patrol teams and install solar lights in communities so that women and girls are able to venture outside after sundown. And a ministerial on gender-based violence in humanitarian emergencies, a meeting co-sponsored by the United States and Sweden, Secretary of State John Kerry announced an additional $17 million for Safe from the Start. If we are to be successful in this effort, said Secretary Kerry, we need to take action. We need a zero-tolerance policy toward gender-based violence against anyone, men, women, and children. We must treat the survivors of violence with the sensitivity, respect, and the dignity that they deserve, and we must bring perpetrators to justice. Finally, to be successful, we must all work together. We have learned in painful and searing ways that gender-based violence can rip families apart, rip communities apart, and attack state structures. And too often, in too many countries, it perpetrates conflict and creates instability for generations, said Secretary of State Kerry. Preventing and dealing with the effects of gender-based violence is a fundamental moral issue. It's a basic question of right versus wrong.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.